This week on Making Contact.
Who are we?
Acorn!
Who are we?
Acorn!
Acorn is, or was, the most effective anti-poverty organization in America.
It took 40 years to build Acorn, the national community organization which at its peak had more than 500,000 members. But it took just a few months to bring it down. Now, local organizers are trying to rebuild from the ground up while not forgetting the lessons they learned.
When the right attacked Acorn, what it did was just spur social justice Frankensteins. There are more of us than there are of them.
On this edition, the assassination of Acorn, and a look at how the group's absence is affecting elections, poverty, and the continuing housing crisis. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
Now we turn to the controversy surrounding Acorn, the community organizers conservatives criticized during the campaign.
The videos reportedly recorded in late July and early August appear to show Acorn employees in several big cities, including Baltimore, Washington, and New York, advising a couple posing as a pimp and prostitute.
And don't say that you're prostituting or whatever.
The Census Bureau has severed its ties, saying it no longer wants Acorn's help counting low-income families. And this week, the Senate voted overwhelmingly to cut off all federal housing money for Acorn. Acorn says it has been targeted unfairly.
In general, what Acorn's major accomplishment was to organize poor people so they would have more power in America, in the economy, and in the electoral system.
Steve Kest was executive director of the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, abbreviated Acorn, from 1990 until 2009.
And that, again, meant more power vis-a-vis or versus those who had the power. And I think that was our major accomplishment, and that is what made people really pissed off, and pissed off enough to go after us.
John Atlas is president of the National Housing Institute and the author of Seeds of Change, the story of Acorn, America's most controversial anti-poverty community organizing group.
For four decades, Acorn basically rewrote the rules of community organizing, engaged several hundred thousand people in 38 states, and in the process, built affordable housing, increased homeownership opportunities for thousands, registered 1 million voters, mostly poor, minorities, black and brown, raised workers' incomes by organizing unions, winning living wage ordinances in dozens of cities, and leading the national movement to increase the minimum wage.
Acorn was for the peoples, work for the peoples and by the peoples, and they was constantly there for you.
Annie McKenzie remembers the first time an Acorn organizer walked down her block in East Oakland, California.
When she came up and she started asking me questions about, what do you want to see in your neighborhood? And I think I took about an hour and a half of her time because I could not stop talking, because I was so excited to see somebody that's taking the time to walk the beat, come into the neighborhood, and at that point,
more than 15 years earlier, back in 1992, Bill Chornow had a similar experience across town in West Oakland.
At the very first neighborhood meeting we had, the organizer from Acorn said virtually nothing. The residents ran the meeting, set the agenda, analyzed what they liked and didn't like about their neighborhood, what they wanted to change, and developed an action plan. Out of that experience, a lot of my neighbors are now involved in politics that had never done anything political before Acorn came and knocked on our doors.
These stories can be heard time and time again in hundreds of communities across the country. At its height, Acorn had 400,000 members, including Bertha Lewis, who eventually became CEO and chief organizer.
The unique thing about Acorn, and now our model is being duplicated, is you not only look out for your members, self-interest for them, but whatever the campaign was, not only had to benefit your members, but change public policy so that it benefited other folks that were in a like situation.
When do we want it?
There was no greater example of the power of Acorn to affect both people and policy than the fights it took on related to the minimum wage. It's April of 2004. In Tampa, Florida, Acorn members are rallying to support a ballot initiative which would raise that state's minimum wage by a dollar.
My name is Travis. I'm out here petitioning to raise minimum wage from $5.15 to $6.15 an hour. Minimum wage should be at least $7 to $8. We're only asking a dollar. It's only $6.15 an hour. Right.
And I'm on minimum wage myself, you know what I'm saying? I'm going to day labor, trying to make it and stuff, $45 a day. Can't nobody, I got three kids. They don't hear us, man. They don't hear us. That's why we're struggling right now. And we're trying to tell them, hey, man, you can't do this to us.
Acorn organizers like Denise Hilton took the lead in collecting almost 500,000 signatures to get the minimum wage increase on the ballot.
We are the people. We have the power. We need to make everybody know that we poor people have more power than rich people because we run the country. We keep it running.
Who are we?
Acorn.
Acorn. Acorn.
Florida voters passed the minimum wage amendment in 2004, and Acorn didn't stop there. In 2006, the group spearheaded voter-approved minimum wage increases in Missouri, Arizona, Colorado, and Ohio. And in January 2007, Congress raised the federal minimum wage for the first time in a decade.
You cannot underestimate how unique it was for an organization to take a reform such as the minimum wage, which most Americans, certainly almost all politicians, both Republicans and Democrats, believed it was not something that needed to be reformed.
Activist and author John Atlas.
Think about issues that affect the poor over the last three decades, and how many issues can you think of where the progressive movement changed the national debate and the national discussion about what was possible and not possible, what was right and wrong in any kind of reform. Well, that's what Acorn did.
But former Acorn executive director Steve Kest says those successes also spawned some powerful enemies.
When we think about minimum wage campaigns, the sort of obvious point is that it increases the living standards of people who are poor by putting more money in their pockets. The flip side of that is it takes money out of other people's pockets to put in their pockets. So it is more money that the people, stock shareholders, people who run corporations, whether it's McDonald's or Walmart or whatever, have to pay to their workers. And they didn't like that.
Increasing wages was just one of Acorn's many successful campaigns. They fought for tenants' rights and helped force a crackdown on lending practices that prevented homeownership by low-income people. Acorn also warned of predatory lending years before it hit the headlines and got all 50 state attorney generals to support a class action suit. And they played a major role in rehabilitating New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. But Bertha Lewis says the most threatening thing about Acorn to its ideological enemies was how it mobilized low-income people to vote.
At our height, Acorn accounted for 25% of all voter registration. Karl Rove in 2004 put his sights on us because we had a minimum wage ballot initiative in Florida. We registered over 1 million people, and we moved those people to the polls based on issues. Even though George Bush won that state, people who may have voted for Bush also went to other sections of the ballot and voted to raise the minimum wage. That was dangerous. The New York Times published Karl Rove's emails saying, "This is the real danger to the Republican Party and to the right. We must go after them."
Karl Rove's fears came to fruition in 2008, according to former Acorn executive director Steve Kest.
I mean, in 08, we registered over 1 million new low-income voters, almost all of them of color. These were the Obama surge voters who would not have voted had they not been registered, right? You got to remember back, the excitement of that campaign, really the excitement was in the last couple months when it really seemed possible but that this guy no one had ever heard of was going to be elected. Well, at that point, had people not been registered, it would have been too late. So our registration drive started a year ahead of time. And we looked state by state, and some of the key states that he won, the number of people we registered was the margin of difference. That is what McCain said in that debate with Obama, where he said,
"Acorn,
who is now on the verge of maybe perpetrating one of the greatest frauds in voter history in this country, maybe destroying a fabric of democracy.
He said Acorn was the greatest threat to democracy. They were looking at those new registrations.
Coming up in just a minute, how a con artist in a pimp costume helped take Acorn down. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, South Africa, and Australia. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact.
Would Acorn employee Juan Carlos consult his contacts in Mexico to find a way to help us smuggle the underage girls into the United States from Tijuana?
What things do you need from me in terms of like the shipment information? Like, what can I help you? What information would you further need, would help you in advice you would give me?
The location.
The location?
Would the Acorn employees encourage the prostitute to cheat on her taxes by getting child tax credit for the underage girls?
Under 16?
Yeah.
So you're eligible to get, you'll be able to get child tax credit?
Would they give her guidance on how not to get busted by the federal government?
You're not going to use all of us.
And would they give her street tactics on how not to get in trouble with her abusive pimp?
Be careful. Train them to keep their mouth shut. Always keep your eyes in the back of your head. Police don't put pressure on you. I can't cover you.
Yes, yes, and yes.
Those are some clips from videos in which Acorn employees appear to be offering housing and tax advice to two people pretending to be a sex worker and a pimp. The videos set in motion a chain of events that would lead to Acorn's collapse, but what wasn't known at the time was that the videos were highly doctored. The filmmaker was named James O'Keefe. The videos were promoted on websites owned by Andrew Breitbart. Breitbart, along with Fox News, supplied the drumbeat for a relentless attack on Acorn that developed. But how about we let Steve Kest, Acorn's former executive director, tell the rest of the story?
There were three strikes, and I think we may have survived one of them, even perhaps two of them, but three together was really more than we could handle. So the first was our own internal screw-up, which was the embezzlement scandal, where the brother of the founder stole a fairly large sum of money, almost $1 million, from the organization. And the leadership of the organization at that time, which included me, made a judgment to keep that quiet and arrange a payback deal with the guy who stole the money. That took place in 1999-2000. That came out in 2008. And then on top of that, we were doing our voter registration drive, and it was during this time that the Republicans and Fox started focusing on what they alleged to be voter registration fraud.
Widespread allegations of voter fraud in many states across the country, and one organization appears to be at the center of it all. It's called Acorn.
In all, over a dozen states are looking into the validity of Acorn's submitted voter registration.
Former employees of Acorn tell me, Paul, that the organization may have a plan to overload the election system. Chaos is often Acorn's friend.
All right. And they created a narrative that was picked up widely in the press that we were about to steal the election through fraudulent means and putting fraudulent voters on the rolls. And then the third strike was really the sort of takedown by this filmmaker O'Keefe and Breitbart. These were these doctored videos where they came into Acorn offices or Acorn housing offices with stories about people who needed help.
Last year, they attacked the president and his campaign for ties to the group.
Those allegations didn't stick, but these videos, shown frequently on Fox News Channel, seem to constitute a tipping point. The Census Bureau has canceled its relationship with Acorn. The Senate voted to kill Acorn housing grants, and Republicans are calling for investigations.
These are not isolated incidents. Acorn's been charged with voter fraud.
Anyway, these videos were totally doctored to make it look like we were colluding in underage prostitution rings. And at that point, even those who had stuck with us, politicians, funders, others, through the first two strikes, threw up their hands and said, this is, as Chuck Schumer said to us directly, this is a bridge too far. I can't help you on this one.
In reality, the man wearing the pimp costume took it off before entering Acorn's offices. Acorn was required by law to give tax advice to anyone who asked for it, regardless of their profession. And one Acorn employee even called the police to report what the couple told him about their involvement in underage prostitution. But those details didn't make the headlines, and by March 2010, 6 months after the doctored videos were released, the organization that had taken almost 40 years to build up had folded. An investigation requested by Congress later cleared Acorn of any wrongdoing, but it was too late. Although Acorn only received 10% of its budget from the government, foundations and private donors had been scared off by the scandals as well.
There are lessons to be learned related to Acorn that all of us in progressive national organizations need to take home and really think about.
Ina Gutierrez is Deputy Director of Operations for the Chicago-based Interfaith Worker Justice.
I think it's easy to say that the right wing attacked, but that takes all the control out of the hands of the organization. And I think there were things that Acorn could have done, having a good PR message and having a strong communication strategy. And I also think that money is a real issue. And so how do we figure out how to fund our organizations and our networks in a way that we have control and we're not at the beck and call of traditional funders, national foundations, government money, et cetera.
So have those lessons been learned? And perhaps more importantly, what happened to the group's 500,000 members and the issues they spent decades organizing around?
Yes, we won. We won today. Yay!
We beat today.
They're trying to take my house.
It's a sunny summer morning in West Oakland, and Tasha Alberti is celebrating that she can stay in her home, at least for another 7 days. Alberti's home was scheduled to be foreclosed on this morning, but around 50 people showed up preparing to prevent the sheriff from entering. News vans followed. Then Martha Daniels, vice president of Oakland Acorn's foreclosure chapter, got the crowd on their cell phones to contact the bank that held the mortgage.
100 people called the sheriff's office. Over 100 people called the bank, and the bank called the broker, and the broker called the sheriff, and they called it off.
So this is all taking place back in July of 2009. If the story sounds familiar, it's because similar actions have taken place all over the country in the past few years. As one of their last major campaigns, Acorn helped pioneer foreclosure defense actions.
The banks don't want negative publicity. And at this point, we're trying to get the word out there that this works.
Bill Chorno was an Acorn member for 18 years.
That if people will stay in their houses, call Acorn or call their minister, call, you know, any community organization that supports housing and network with people. If a lot of people start doing this, we're going to see a lot more concessions out of the banking industry, and hopefully we'll be able to get a moratorium on foreclosures. We've got to normalize this kind of activity so that people feel more comfortable saying, I'm not going to leave my house. This is crazy.
Acorn's fall began only a couple months after this home defense in Oakland. And in California, as in many other states, the members and organizers had to jump ship. Many formed new local or statewide groups that maintained the commitment to have low-income people in positions of leadership and make their own decisions. There's the Texas Organizing Project, Missourians Organizing for Reform and Empowerment, New England United for Justice, and in California, as Jen Chien reports, the Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment has taken on foreclosure defense as one of their primary issues.
Back in the fall of 2011, Vivian Richardson was facing a double dose of difficulty.
I was at home recovering from a head-on car accident.
At the same time, the house in which she was recuperating was being threatened by foreclosure by Wells Fargo Bank. She'd applied multiple times for a loan modification with no success when an idea landed in her lap.
I was laying on the sofa watching TV, watching the evening news, and I saw Tanya Dennis, who lives in Oakland, and she reoccupied her home.
Dennis says this was, is, and always will be her home, whether the bank likes it or not.
I didn't really break back in my house. I just repossessed my home. That sounds a lot gentler.
After Tanya Dennis had won a loan modification from the bank, and Richardson was intrigued as she watched the victorious Dennis and her supporters on the screen.
And I saw these wonderful yellow T-shirts that had the letters ACE written across it, A-C-C-E. And I was like, what the heck is that? And of course, as the newscasters were talking, they explained what ACE was.
ACE is the Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment. It was founded by former employees of ACORN as that national organization folded in 2010. Like its predecessor, ACE's philosophy is about empowering low-income and working people to become active around the issues that affect them. That sounded good to Vivian Richardson.
I got on the internet on my laptop and looked up ACE and got a number, called.
Richardson soon received a visitor at her home.
My name is Grace Martinez. I am a community organizer with the San Francisco chapter of ACE.
And she asked me if I was ready to fight for what I thought was right and mine, and I absolutely was. And with a cast and bandages and everything else, I was doing press releases, press conferences in front of my home, down at City Hall.
I'm Vivian Richardson. I am a Bayview resident, and I am a foreclosure fighter.
It was a lot of people, a lot of press. And so the neighbors saw it, and then we started having others kind of join in and fighting for their homes.
So far, Richardson has been able to stay in her home with the help of about 200 people who've joined ACE's Foreclosure and Eviction Fighters Committee. Grace Martinez says that committee is ACE's largest, and that wasn't a choice made by her or by the group's other two employees.
Actually, the members decided this is what they wanted to work with.
Martinez says this is a core part of how ACE works, organizing from the bottom up. It's part of the legacy of ACORN that still permeates ACE. Martinez herself had worked for more than 5 years at ACORN's San Francisco chapter until it closed in late 2009 as funds dried up amidst the growing scandal.
And this is a Fox News alert. Two more ACORN officials have been fired as the shocking undercover investigation has now spread to that organization's Washington offices. And that's not all.
ACE formed in early 2010 with the former head organizer of ACORN California as its executive director. ACE eventually employed many other former ACORN staffers like Martinez. But in the months between the collapse of one organization and the formation of a new one, some dedicated field organizers simply continued to do their work.
Because we still had people going through foreclosure, because there was no ACORN, we continued to do some activism, and some of the staff just went on unemployment just to continue working with the people that we had.
ACE now has 6 chapters throughout the state, with headquarters in Los Angeles. San Francisco ACE has over 1,000 dues-paying members. In addition to the recent focus on foreclosure fighting, ACE members have been involved in issues ranging from public school reform to job training to voter outreach.
The members that I've been working with now are, a lot of them are new to activism, many of them who had never been to a protest or an action before.
I grew up in the 60s, but I never was a part of the civil rights fight. But I think it's kind of laid back and something that was always in me, but I never had a chance to use it.
Neely Yarbrough got involved with ACE while searching for help for her 92-year-old uncle, who was facing foreclosure on his home of more than 40 years. On a tip from a housing counselor, she went to the weekly meeting of the Foreclosure and Eviction Fighters Committee, where she met people like Vivian Richardson. Just as Richardson had been inspired by Tanya Dennis's story on TV, Yarbrough heard stories of victory over the banks and decided she wanted to fight, too.
What members of ACE do, when they fight their foreclosures, but they also fight and help other people too. That is one of the requirements. And we also vote on ideas, how best to handle the actions and stuff. It's not just one person that says, oh, we should do this. We sit down and we talk about it.
Working with ACE, with other people in the similar situations, brought to my attention I wasn't alone.
ACE member Ian Haddo is also fighting foreclosure on his home. Before joining the group, he says he was depressed and ashamed, literally hiding under the covers in his bedroom.
By aggregating my voice with other people's voices, I compounded my power. It was not a simple addition, it was a multiplication of power, an exponential gain.
Haddo is a librarian and says he's usually shy and reserved, but at a recent protest action with ACE.
I danced and chanted as we walked along Market Street along with everybody else, and it was exhilarating.
Staff organizer Grace Martinez says she loves seeing this kind of growth happening.
You know, I'm not a very spiritual person, but I feel really blessed to work with people who are ready to take back, you know, what's theirs and fight the good fight and, you know, and see them as develop as, like, community leaders and not feel like victims and really, like, you know, change that conversation.
Neely Yarbrough says she's ready to start changing that conversation on a broader level. She never used to pay attention to politics or elections, but she's recently become one of the leaders of ACE's Election Outreach Committee.
Like I say, I joined San Francisco ACE because of my uncle and him going through the foreclosure and stuff like that. But then also, too, if you get involved in what's happening, you know, in your government, local, state, even, you know, the whole country, you've got to, your one vote counts. You know, and a lot of people think, you know, it doesn't really make a difference. But if everybody thought about that, where would we be?
Come out and talk to us. Don't throw us.
At a recent action sponsored by San Francisco ACE, foreclosure fighters confront a billionaire investor at his home in the wealthy Silicon Valley suburb of Atherton. Yarbrough's 13-year-old daughter, Darnetta, is the one holding the bullhorn. A few weeks ago, this wouldn't have been the case.
First, I think she was kind of a little embarrassed because she didn't want her friends to know exactly what was going on. But I told her that was not, it was no inflection on her. It was something that happened to Uncle Robert. And the best way for us to help him is to, you know, get out and fight, get petitions signed, and show him that we support him.
Yarbrough says she's happy her daughter is participating and hopes she'll follow in her mom's newly found activist footsteps.
I would like for her to, but I mean, you know, whatever she chooses to do, that's okay. I know what I'm going to do.
And what's that?
I want to continue to fight.
For Making Contact, I'm Jen Chien in San Francisco.
Groups like ACE are doing work all over the country, but it's not as coordinated without the multi-state umbrella group like ACORN. And it remains to be seen if they can take on voter registration in the same way without that national network. Some see the 2012 voter ID laws being promoted across the country as an attack on a population that has lost one of its key defenders. What role might ACORN have played in that debate, if they were still around? And what about the groups that grew out of ACORN? What have they learned?
When the right attacked ACORN, what it did was just spur social justice Frankenstein. People got so outraged and they said, you know what? We know what the attack looks like now. We can protect ourselves against that and we will proliferate.
What happened to ACORN is that it's a story of hope. It's a story of hope. Now, why is it a story of hope? Well, because ACORN was so successful. And what they did to become so successful, you can't take away, you can't make disappear. There are tactics and strategies that the group used that ended up being very, very effective.
What the right and those conservatives don't understand is there are more of us than there are of them.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to Demos and to Race, Poverty, and the Environment. Check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.